Welcome to the Greater Possibilities podcast from Invesco, where we put concerns into context and opportunities into focus. I'm Brian Levitt.
And I'm Jody Phillips. And this is the first part of a two-part conversation we're having with Justin Livengood. Justin is a senior portfolio manager for the Invesco Midcap Growth Strategy, and he's a senior research analyst for our discovery and capital appreciation strategies. His focus is on financials, real estate, and healthcare. So we last talked to Justin almost a year ago. Brian, did you know that that episode was our most downloaded episode for 2023?
Oh, is that right?
It is. I checked the numbers.
I don't think I knew that. So I guess I'm glad that we're having him back on then. I mean, Jody, as you know, I am paid by the download. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
You'll have to tell me later how you got that deal.
Oh, you didn't get that deal?
No, but we'll worry about that later. As you will remember, Justin came on the week that Silicon Valley Bank failed. And so we brought him on then to give his perspectives and to help ease concerns at that time.
Oh, okay. I see. So are you saying it wasn't about Justin? It was just about a crisis. So maybe we just need to manufacture some crises in order to get downloads here.
That is not at all what I'm saying. Those things do tend to go hand in hand, but I would be more than happy to give up a few downloads if it meant fewer crises to deal with.
Oh, I would 100% take that trade off also.
All right. Look, so do you remember what Justin said on that March 2023 podcast?
I do, and I've been rereading it this week. I always write down my key takeaways. So here are the two things that I wrote that Justin had said that month. Number one, it's not a systemic crisis.
Okay.
And he said the credit picture in the banking system is clean. And number two, he said we're returning to a proper equilibrium in monetary policy that may help provide a stronger base for the economy and the stock market from which to operate in the next 2 to 3 years.
That's some very thorough note-taking, Brian. That's great. And it feels like he was two for two.
It does. Credit to Justin, which is why we're having him back.
Yeah, because despite that, the questions about the health of the U.S. banking system keep emerging, don't they?
They do. And I get the sense that investors just feel like something has to break. We can't have the type of interest rate hikes that we've had over the last year without anything meaningfully breaking or impacting the banking system.
So potentially concerns about office space, commercial real estate?
Yeah, I think that's the first candidate being put forth by investors.
All right. So these are the questions we'll talk about in the first part of our conversation. And then we've got a lot of other questions we can focus on for the second part. We have a growth manager here. Let's take advantage of it. So market concentration, the excitement about the Magnificent Seven, themes like artificial intelligence, is that excitement warranted or are we getting ahead of ourselves?
Right. And what would have to happen for markets to broaden out, or do we just own growth stocks for the rest of our lives?
All right. Well, let's bring on Justin to discuss. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Justin.
Hi, Jody. Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming back. So you probably felt pretty good when I was reading verbatim what you said on the last podcast. So did it feel good what you said, and has anything materially changed in your mind?
Well, I'm glad the economy has hung in there. Yeah. I'm frankly shocked the economy has hung in there to the degree it has in the last year. I think the Fed would say the same thing. I think everyone was expecting more of a slowdown than we've seen. I'm also pleased the banking system has hung in. I mean, you're right. I mean, at the time of the failures of First Republic, Silicon Valley, and Signature, I mean, there were some very anxious days and weeks, and we got through that relatively well. So I'm happy that all that played out. And as you pointed out in your earlier comments, there's definitely some incremental concerns now to consider, but I don't feel it's nearly as much of a dangerous situation as it was last March.
And one of the critical points that you had made last March was that it was not a credit event, right? It was a mismanagement of the interest rate sensitivity of the bank.
Exactly. Right? It was a liquidity event. Those three banks in particular were somewhat unique in how they were built, and they had concentrations in terms of clients and deposits. And especially at Silicon Valley and First Republic, when those depositors got spooked and a meaningful portion of those ran for the exits, it just started a downward spiral in terms of liquidity. And that's what forced the hands of those two. And that's why they were not anticipated properly by the regulators. The regulators don't historically look at much asset liability issues and liquidity, they spend more time looking at credit. So what we're going through right now is actually right in the sweet spot of what the regulators have all been trained to do. You know, dealing with bad loans, that's one, that's banking 101 for a regulator. So this next phase of the, we'll call it the slow moving banking crisis, but banking challenge, is at least something that the regulators are more adept at handling. And we can talk about that.
Yeah, great. Let's do. I think, what was it, late January, Justin, where we saw kind of the concerns flare up a bit around New York Community Bank
That's
when
right.
it declared its earnings had been well below expectations. And so, you know, some concerns may have been lingering in the background, but that really brought it to the fore pretty suddenly for some investors, it may seem. So what are maybe some of the similarities or differences between what happened then versus maybe where we were a year ago?
Yeah. So let's step back a second and think about the banking industry, and particularly the regional banking industry. So put aside maybe the top five or six banks, the Chases and the Wells Fargos. You know, going back 3 years or so when the pandemic began, you began to see a little bit of concern and emerging pressure on certain types of loans tied to commercial real estate and specifically office. And those have been building for a while. So that didn't just appear in January of this year for the first time. That's been an ongoing issue. Most loans in those categories made by regional banks are 5 to 7 year duration loans or term loans. And, you know, so those loans are starting to get late in their life at a point when they would typically get refinanced and replaced with new loans. And of course, as the values of those underlying buildings have come down, the owners of the buildings are having to face the difficult choice of either accepting less equity, you know, writing off a lot of their investment in the property as they take on the new loan, or putting in new equity and trying to, you know, take on new debt, but at higher rates. And that puts more pressure on cash flow. So it's a difficult, but somewhat predictable and slow process as it plays out over time. It's not a flash like, again, we had last March. Last March, again, was not a credit event. It was a reaction by investors, by depositors to a, it turned out to be kind of a false concern that forced these banks into effectively the regulators' hands. Here, the regulators have had several years to kind of watch and work with a lot of these regional banks as they've been starting to cull their loan portfolios and sift through some of these commercial real estate loans. And so the good news is what happened in January with New York Community Bank was actually somewhat precipitated by the regulators. It was during the year-end audit of 2023 that the regulators sat down with those bankers in New York Community and said, "Hey guys, look, you've got a handful of loans that are just not performing. And it's time that you accept this and we reclassify them as non-performers. And in doing so, you're going to have to now make some adjustments to your capital ratios. You're going to have to move some things around your balance sheet. You're probably going to need to cut back your dividend." And this was also happening as New York Community Bank was absorbing, ironically, the legacy assets of Signature Bank. And in doing so, they became bigger in terms of assets, deposits, et cetera. And so that put them under even more and greater requirements. You know, capital ratios and things were changing. So they were under more scrutiny by the regulators just because of that transaction.
Right.
And as part of that review with the regulators into the year, said, "Hold on, you know, you've got to come clean on a few of these loans." And that's what was confessed during the Q4 earnings call by New York Community.
So should you never come to the rescue, right? If you're New York Community Bank, or there are spots where if you step in and take over a Signature Bank, where it actually works out over time.
Oh, it does. And I'll show you another example. J.P. Morgan has absolutely come out like a hero with First Republic.
Mm-hmm.
They took over First Republic last March, and it has been a huge home run, both financially, I think, as well as just building capital for JP Morgan with the regulators and in the eyes of Washington. So yeah, I don't want to suggest that coming to the rescue of a bank isn't a good thing. In this case, though, New York Community, by helping take some of those Signature assets, got bigger than perhaps they should have in hindsight. And it forced them into this new bucket of regulatory scrutiny. As the regulators applied those new rules, they realized, wait a minute, you guys aren't completely on sides with at least some of these loans. And that reset is now happening. It's probably also worth noting, New York Community is a pretty unusual bank. As the name suggests, they're geographically focused in New York and really the Long Island area. They have a very high proportion of their loans in multifamily and office. Although when they say office, they're not talking about buildings in Midtown. They're talking about, you know, 5 to 7 story buildings in some of the outlying boroughs and so forth. So it's a much more concentrated loan portfolio in terms of commercial real estate and office than the typical bank. A typical bank has a single digit percent of its loans right. in these types of categories, whereas New York Community, it's 30-40%. So it exaggerates the optics, the risks, the issues that are very much under scrutiny here.
So let's talk about office. You and I are sitting here right now in downtown New York City. We're back in our high rise. I'm here half the time, maybe.
Right. Same.
Right. Flexible program. Jody, you're in the office today,
Not today. But yeah, we definitely have this office in Houston. So.
Well, right now you're in the Phillips office in Houston.
That's right.
Correct?
That's right. Correct.
Yeah. And so, how concerned are you about office space? To me, it seems like businesses were needing less office space even before the pandemic happened. You no longer needed rooms for file cabinets, or you no longer needed rooms for servers, right? All of that was moving. Now, I think the last I saw in terms of the number of people swiping in at offices, around 50%. New York City might be a little bit less than that, although my commute would suggest otherwise.
Right.
And the line downstairs for the salad might suggest otherwise.
Exactly.
But how worried are you? And you talk about a slow moving, did you call it a train wreck, a crisis?
Yeah. It's maybe not quite a train wreck, but it's a slow moving process.
A derailment.
Right.
And so how worried are you that there's something lurking within that's unforeseen? I mean, it's comforting to me to hear you talk about the regulators being in front of it with New York Community Bank. Are you concerned that there's something lurking out there?
I don't think there's something lurking, again, because I think it's fairly well known what everyone in the regional banking industry particularly owns at this point, where their exposures are. And I think, you know, there's stress testing that goes on that forces banks to, you know, consider what is going to happen to their loans and their assets in different economic scenarios. And there are some pretty punitive scenarios that the regulators make you consider. And then based on how you do in those tests, you have to adjust your dividend policies and perhaps your capers. So the industry right now is really well capitalized.
Good.
And in general, and that even goes down to a lot of the smaller banks. Even New York Community, by the way, despite having to disclose those and write down some of those big loans last month, they're still above what is defined as well capitalized. It removed a cushion, but it wasn't like they had to go out and do a dilutive financing overnight to suddenly get back on sides. Here are a couple more interesting statistics that I recently read to kind of help maybe frame this. So there are about $40 billion of reserves right now in the banking industry set aside specifically for office and commercial real estate loans. And that represents about a 1.5. Let me put it this way. Right now, 1.5% of all office loans made by banks are considered delinquent.
Okay.
If things get as bad as they did in the global financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, that delinquency rate would go to 6%.
Wow.
That's where we topped out at in the worst situation that these banks have probably ever faced. And that's the kind of stress test scenario that the banks have been getting put through in recent years. So in other words, you've got a room for delinquencies and losses on this category of loans to quadruple. And you're only back to where we were in the GFC,
right?
On losses.
Well, we don't want to be in.
We don't want to be there. But if we were, hypothetically, you know what the dollar value of losses would be? Round numbers, $40
billion. $40 billion.
Which happens to be where the industry is roughly reserved. So again, it's not a scenario I want.
Right.
But if it happened, it wouldn't happen overnight. Like back in March of 23, it wouldn't be like all of a sudden on a weekend, we're worrying about six banks going under because they suddenly realized they had two bad office loans. Furthermore, as they were taking write-downs on loans, they would presumably just be drawing on reserves already set aside. So the only thing that really concerns me, and I've heard bank CEOs say this, so this isn't really just my opinion, is if the economy were to take a left turn and get worse, and other property classes started to struggle, other types of loans.
Like multifamily or...
Right, or even just, you know, residential mortgages.
Oh, don't say residential mortgages.
Traditional commercial loans, exactly. If other pockets of a bank's balance sheet started to also see growing losses, which right now isn't happening, then you'd have other things eating away at bank reserves and capital, and then this office slash commercial real estate situation would perhaps become more of a concern. But I think at the end of the day, this as long as the economy cooperates, and I don't think it needs to do much more than it currently is. It is remarkably resilient at the moment. I think banks are going to have enough time, as will the regulators, to over a 2 to 3 year period get the worst of these loans around office buildings and commercial real estate to where they need to be in terms of refinanced, re-equitized, and the industry will be on more solid footing. Now, having said that, there's a second reality that these banks are facing as this process slowly
I was
slips
feeling,
out.
Jody, were you feeling better?
I was until we're entering the alternate reality. No. So
I'm not good with second reality. My brain only works on one reality.
It's not all bad.
Okay.
If you say so.
But banks aren't making as many loans as they used to.
Okay.
Because of this.
Right.
All right. So this isn't just back to business as usual at banks. And this is one thing we talked about a year ago that I suspected. Like, hey, it's going to take a long time for underwriters and staff at banks to be told and allowed to go back to writing as many loans. And those loans they are writing, they're, of course, you know, and I'm not just talking about office. I'm talking about, again, you know, loans to individual companies and, you know,
isn't that
individuals.
If you have 3% inflation, isn't that a good thing? I maybe not 3%, but we were at 4-5% inflation. Isn't that a good thing? We were trying to slow down this economy, right?
Right.
So, but the problem is you get to 2% inflation and then things continue to slow. Is that what, and then the Fed's got to ease and try and reinvigorate credit creation, economic activity again?
Right. So some of this, there's two issues. One issue, which I was driving at, is just because banks are still trying to get properly capitalized and reserved for some of these lingering credit issues, they can't make new loans and grow as much as they used to. In fact, the industry basically did not grow in the fourth quarter.
Right.
New loans were flat in the fourth quarter of 2023. And the outlook that banks gave for 24 is pretty flattish. It varies by type of loan. It varies a little bit by geography. But basically, there isn't credit formation from the banks.
Right.
Now, there is credit formation happening outside of the banking system.
Shadow banking system.
This whole private credit phenomenon is real. It's going to have legs. And we can come back and talk about this because I'm very close to a lot of the firms that are involved in that space. And I think that is a big durable trend. But what's happening is a mix shift away from the regional banks to other providers. We can call it shadow banking, but that has a little bit of a negative connotation that I'm not sure is fair.
Right.
I think actually it's somewhat healthy to have some incremental growth in the private side of the lending market. Now, the second thing that you were referring to is sort of, you know, what do we want to do in terms of interest rate policy and the Fed? So the other thing the banks are having to deal with right now is the curve's still inverted.
Right.
And the front end of that curve's still 5.25%, 5.5%. That's not good.
But they're not paying that, right?
Oh, on incremental deposits and borrowings, the Fed window they are.
Okay.
So,
but if I go to the bank, I'm getting 0.1%.
Well, if right? you're at one of the big banks who don't want your deposits, you're right. Chase and B of A aren't going to pay anything.
Okay.
But if you're a smaller bank, you know, a lot of regional banks are still dependent on time deposits like CDs and some money market checking type products, which are, if they're not at the Fed funds rate, they're still elevated. You know, it's 3-4.5% type things. Bank funding costs over the last 12 to 18 months have gone up faster than anyone expected, notably the banks. And that has squeezed their margins because their loans reprice quickly to rates, but only up to where usually the 5 or 10 year is, because most loans are priced longer term. Deposits and funding are priced short term. So this inverted yield curve that has stubbornly stuck around is slowly squeezing margin
right.
on the banks and on the industry. So yeah, the Fed is watching this and having to, of course, juggle lots of different things when they're thinking about setting monetary policy. And one of their concerns is, boy, the longer we leave the Fed funds rate where it is in our attempt to fight inflation, which I think is the right move, we're pressuring those banks who at the very same time we're telling to get their houses in order on some of these loans and get your credit ratio, your capital ratios up. So it is a little bit of a moving game that the banks are having to deal with.
Jody, I got two things for you. One, it sounds like I might have my deposits in the wrong place. I might have been sleeping for the last year and a half.
Perhaps you were.
And two, did you notice Justin doing the shape of his yield curve on his elbow?
Yeah, that was really impressive.
In a podcast. It's going to be good for the podcast.
Exactly.
I have to add a video component for this one.
it was not ideal for an audio-only
situation.
He's
a New Yorker. But... he speaks with his hands.
That's
gestures.
Right. That's right.
For sure.
That's right.
So, Justin, what about any ripple effects in the broader markets? I mean, it doesn't really feel like we're feeling anything at this point in time, but, you know, what... in terms of banking concerns, you know, would you be watching out for just in terms of any broader market impact?
I think that as it relates to the economy, we're largely okay in terms of what the banks are doing. And I don't think the banks pose a major risk. Again, there has been now a multi-year period where the majority of banks have been able to get their houses in order. And it's only going to be outliers like New York Community that are going to be, you know, in the headlines and running into issues with regulators. The system by and large is in great shape. I mean, Jamie Dimon just said that yesterday at a conference. I've heard that song and verse from other large bank CEOs in the last few months. And you listen to the larger banks, you know, the top 25 banks. I mean, they just came through Q4 earnings with mostly flat loan loss provisions and non-performing assets were flat to down. So the big diversified banks are, if anything, I mean, having a great stretch of performance. They're not posing a risk to the economy. They're not posing a risk to the markets. They're very healthy and happy. And smaller banks, again, have had time for the most part to get into the position they need to be in to manage these credit risks. So I think they'll continue to be outliers like New York Community. I think there'll be some headlines and some moments of concern. But as long as the economy continues to chug along at an okay rate, and as long as the Fed is at least done tightening and tilting towards making rate cuts as we move into next year, I think the industry, the banking industry in general, is going to be fine. And now, it's not going to be an impediment to growth.
We talked about private and credit as a durable theme. I get a lot of questions. What are your thoughts on private markets, right? It's like the new, everybody's focused on it. So somebody says to you, what are your thoughts on the private credit market? When you think of it as a durable theme, should investors be looking in that space? I know you're focusing on it from the players, from the financial players in that space, but investors looking for incremental yield or opportunities they may not otherwise have, private credit makes sense to you, it sounds like?
Absolutely. So I'll back up. I think credit makes a lot of sense right now. So I also think that public credit is really interesting.
Investment grade corporates, 5% yield.
Or high yield corporates even.
8%, 9% yield.
Yeah. Going back to where we started a minute ago, Brian, I am stunned at the resiliency of the economy and its ability to absorb what the Fed has done. You know, as we sit here today, unemployment, Q1 expected GDP, and inflation are all between 3.5% and 4%.
And people are miserable.
People are miserable.
That's cost of living.
But the stock market is making new highs.
New highs, right.
But my point is, it's stunning that you would have, at a moment when, you know, the Fed has pushed rates to their highest in over a decade, those three numbers I quoted a moment ago.
Right.
And as long as those three numbers stay there, I don't think the Fed's going to be in any rush to go anywhere in terms of cutting rates. So I think that's really bullish for credit in general, because I think you're a lot of loans. Now I'm going to segue a little bit to your private credit comment. I think there's a lot of value in again, high grade and high yield public credit. But even on the private side, they're getting to underwrite new loans to businesses, whether it's tied to real estate or it's just, you know, straight up corporate type lending, as though you're going to have a normalized credit experience. And that's not what's happening. So I'm hearing all the time from the Blackstones and the KKRs that I get to talk to that this is a once in a decade, maybe once in a 20-year kind of career opportunity. Like you're getting, you know, interest rates on new loans that is low double digits with terms that are typically only seen in the best of times from a lender standpoint. And it's because borrowers don't have those regional banks, those companies that are kind of on the line from a credit standpoint that can't tap the public markets that would normally go to a regional bank or some bank to get that next piece of financing. The banks are saying, hold on, I'm in this shutdown mode. I got to get my, you know, finish getting my house in order. I can't give you a competitive loan. So they turn to a lot of these private pools of money. So yeah, I'm actually quite bullish on credit. It's also a good thing for someone like me that sits in the small mid-cap equity world, because a lot of my small mid-cap companies are in fact those same companies tapping private credit, or at least the high yield kinds of public credit markets. And this is fine for them. Like they're able to get, you know, decent funding and execute their business plans and do well. And that's partly why now you're seeing the stock market, both the large cap and smaller cap parts of the market, do well. You know, people are comfortable that we've threaded the needle on a soft landing, and they're able to get financing where they see growth opportunities. So even though loan growth in the banks, I said earlier, has stalled out as an industry, this private capital opportunity, particularly on the private credit side, is adequately filling the hole. And I think it's, I don't think it's reckless. I don't think it's shadow, for the most part, shadow type.
It does sound
institution.
Very concerning.
I think it's good money. And it's frankly, it's good money, or it's a good trend in some ways, because it's removing some of the risk from the regulated banking industry. If sophisticated institutional investors at a private credit fund take a loss on a loan, that's probably not a systemic risk. But if a bank goes down because they made a bad loan,
right,
well, now we've got to tap the FDIC, you know, trust fund to repay the depositors, and we've got to go, you know, deal with the broader systemic risk that could pose to the banking industry. Well, if we're moving some of those risks off to, at the moment, what seems to be a relatively thoughtful and sophisticated private credit industry, that's not a bad thing.
Jody, should we pivot to part two?
Well, I think we should, unless there's a third reality he's about to spring on us, which I hope not, because I'm feeling pretty good with where we are. And that's the end of the first part of our conversation. In the second part, we're going to talk to Justin about market concentration and what it might take for market participation to broaden. And we'll spend some time on the potential impact of artificial intelligence, not only on tech companies, but on other sectors that are using this technology in interesting ways. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Invesco's Greater Possibilities podcast. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and are based on current market conditions as of February 27, 2024, and are subject to change without notice. These opinions may differ from those of other Invesco investment professionals. Invesco is not affiliated with any of the companies or individuals mentioned herein. This does not constitute a recommendation of any investment strategy or product for a particular investor. Investors should consult a financial professional before making any investment decisions. Should this contain any forward-looking statements, understand they are not guarantees of future results. They involve risks, uncertainties, and assumptions. There can be no assurance that actual results will not differ materially from expectations. All investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Diversification does not guarantee a profit or eliminate the risk of loss. An investment cannot be made directly in an index. All data provided by Invesco unless otherwise noted. In general, stock values fluctuate sometimes wildly in response to activities specific to the company, as well as general market, economic, and political conditions. Investments in financial institutions may be subject to certain risks, including the risk of regulatory actions, changes in interest rates, and concentration of loan portfolios in an industry or sector. The profitability of businesses in the financial services sector depends on the availability and cost of money and may fluctuate significantly in response to changes in government regulation, interest rates, and general economic conditions. These businesses often operate with substantial financial leverage. Growth stocks tend to be more sensitive to changes in their earnings and can be more volatile. the healthcare industry is subject to risks related to government regulation, obsolescence caused by scientific advances, and technological innovations. Investments in real estate-related instruments may be affected by economic, legal, or environmental factors that affect property values, rents, or occupancies of real estate. Real estate companies, including REITs or similar structures, tend to be small and mid-cap companies, and their shares may be more volatile and less liquid. Stocks of small and mid-sized companies tend to be more vulnerable to adverse developments, may be more volatile, and may be illiquid or restricted as to resale. Many products and services offered in technology-related industries are subject to rapid obsolescence, which may lower the value of the issuers. Statistics about the loan portfolio of New York Community Bank sourced from the U.S. Federal Reserve. The Magnificent Seven refers to Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla. Statistics about the number of people swiping into offices sourced from Castle Systems. Reference to $40 billion in reserves set aside for office and commercial real estate loans and references to delinquency rates sourced from the U.S. Federal Reserve. The hypothetical estimate of the value of losses if the delinquency rate were 6% sourced from Invesco analysis. References to rates on the yield curve sourced from Bloomberg as of February 2024. The yield curve plots interest rates at a set point in time of bonds having equal credit quality but differing maturity dates to project future interest rate changes and economic activity. An inverted yield curve is one in which shorter-term bonds have a higher yield than longer-term bonds of the same credit quality. In a normal yield curve, longer-term bonds have a higher yield. References to interest rates paid on bank deposits sourced from Bankrate.com. The federal funds rate is the rate at which banks lend balances to each other overnight. References to investment-grade yield sourced from Bloomberg, based on the yield to worst of the Bloomberg U.S. Corporate Bond Index, which measures the investment-grade fixed-rate taxable corporate bond market. Yield to worst is the lowest potential yield an investor can receive on a bond without the issuer actually defaulting. References to high-yield bond yield sourced from Bloomberg, based on the yield to worst of the Bloomberg U.S. High Yield Corporate Bond Index, which measures the U.S. dollar-denominated high-yield fixed-rate corporate bond market. References to unemployment data, gross domestic product or GDP, and inflation sourced from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. References to small and mid-cap performance sourced from Bloomberg, based on performance of the Russell 2000 and Russell Mid-Cap Indexes in November and December 2023. The Russell 2000 Index, a trademark service mark of the Frank Russell Company, is an unmanaged index considered representative of small-cap stocks. The Russell Mid-Cap Index is an unmanaged index considered representative of mid-cap stocks. All Russell indexes mentioned are trademarks of the Frank Russell Company. FDIC stands for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The Greater Possibilities Podcast is brought to you by Invesco Distributors, Inc.